All right, good morning, everybody. It is 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning, April 13th. And we're here for the Chemphobia lab, and we're figuring out what it is we want to do for lab today. So what I really want to do is I really want to do more wet lab stuff, but I'm not prepared to do that right now. So that leaves us in the domain of still looking at mass spec, and maybe solidifying some of the concepts around mass spec and some of the skill sets around mass spec. And or we could pick up and we could do a little bit of IR work and review sort of the IR, since that's where we're going to be going, and hopefully going more today is, I don't want to be too redundant with lecture. So I want to pick something that augments lecture but doesn't be redundant with lecture. So let's maybe do a little bit of IR work and see how solid you guys are on IR. That means I need to go to lab, start some lab notes, and do a screen share. And then I've got Zaruba's stuff that he gave you for IR. Let me see if I can find that. That had been given to me and was put up on the Discord. Or maybe more accurately, it was just put up on the Discord. And that's where I need to go and find it. Yeah, that sick PDF, exactly. That's what I'm going to go find. Give me a second to find it. Applications, Discord. I kind of know where it is on there. And then I'll bring it into the iPad. And we could talk about it. And then I'll bring mine into the iPad. Zaruba is admittedly much more detailed than mine. Oh, come on, Discord. I should have known that I should just go get this. I'm doing this the hard way. This is the easy way. So that thing was on here. Come on. And it was in not general, not off topic. Notes and resources. That's mine. And I think, no, that's not it. All right, well, let's bring this in anyway. And then I'll try to find Zaruba's. Okay, so if it wasn't in there, then maybe it was in general.
Wait, Jason, I think you already opened it. You just had to scroll down. It was the one with the colorful text.
Oh, was it?
I think so. Then scroll down. Yep.
Oh, okay. That was it. Sweet. Thank you. I saw all the text and I sort of ignored that looking for the graphic, because I'm unfamiliar with the document. Okay, this is good, because this allows me to take the one that I found and put it juxtaposed up against Zaruba's. Okay, so let's look at Zaruba's for a minute. Identifying the major functional groups. So what he's got here is a lot of color coding, which goes up with his graphic, which is great. And so he starts off with carbonyl. Is a carbonyl present? Check zone 4. And he says that the carbon oxygen double bond, you know, gives rise to strong absorptions in zone 4, which is 2000 to 1600. And the peak is off as the strongest in the spectrum, which is true. It goes down to oftentimes between 10 and 5% transmittance So it's the strongest of the absorptions within the spectrum if it happens to be present. And if it is present, he's got anhydrides, give two absorptions, 1810, 1760. Esters, 13 to 11, which is the CO stretch. So the esters will oftentimes have that CO stretch in addition to the carbonyl. Aldehyde should have two signals, 2800 and 2700. The 2800, though, is tiny, very hard to see. Carboxylic acid should have a broad signal that extends through zone one. All of those things, I think, when you get into the words are much harder to deal with than the images. And so what I like to do is I like to show these rather from words, I like to show these through images. So I'm actually going to skip over the wordy part and just go right to the image, because his image does it much better, does much more justice to it. And so, you know, he breaks it up into the five zones, zone one, zone two, zone three, zone four, and zone five. Zone one is where we see OHs and NHs. These are where we see protons that are protic, what we would describe as being protic. These are the types of hydrogens that have a strong partial positive and like the hydrogen bond. And they have very specific shapes. For hydroxyl groups, they're very broad and smooth. For amines, they're smaller, single for a primary and double for a secondary amine. I think I actually said that in reverse, and I think he's got it labeled in reverse. A primary amine has two hydrogens on it. The primary amine is what gives this pattern. And a secondary amine that only has one hydrogen on it gives this one pattern. So his numbers here are actually slightly reversed. I think he was thinking about how many hydrogens they have on the nitrogen as opposed to the type of nitrogen. Carboxylic acids give what we call sort of the jagged, shaggy beard type pattern that that goes over this. So all those different patterns in there. In zone two is darn near worthless. Zone two is carbon-hydrogen stretches. And because every molecule has carbon-hydrogen stretches, it is very difficult and challenging to really find anything in zone two that is worthwhile. Now, he cites aldehydes, that if you happen to have an aldehyde, that aldehydes have this particular sort of pattern to the aldehyde. However, within the carbon-hydrogen stretches, all kinds of things can have that pattern. And so while aldehydes do have that pattern, many other things do too. And so I don't see a whole lot of value in looking for that aldehyde pattern right in there. In zone three is where we typically see carbon dioxide show up at as a contaminant. This is when people are preparing their IR spectrums and they exhale onto the sample while they're preparing it. That exhalation onto the sample will give you a strong CO2 spike, and it can be fairly strong. It can be a medium peak that is in within this. And so these other things, carbon-carbon triple bonds and the nitriles, these guys are also relatively weak and hard to identify and hard to see. So zone two and zone three, for me, I almost completely ignore them. Now zone four, where the carbonyl shows up, this is between 2000 and I think he takes it down to 1600. Yes, the carbonyl spectrum area is really important. And he's got the different peaks listed here for the different types of carbonyls, which can be helpful. And then in the fingerprint zone is really used much like an FBI fingerprint scan, where if the fingerprint zone matches a particular compound and you're looking at a reference spectrum and you have a match between the fingerprint and the reference spectrum, then you're fairly assured that the reference and the compound under investigation are the same. And there are some functional groups. There are actually, these are all functional groups that show up in here. However, there are so many and they overlap to such a degree as to be nearly worthless as identifying or trying to identify the actual compound. So Keegan, are there in particular precautions taken to avoid CO2 input, like breathing in a mask? Yes and no. What you do is when you learn about particularly using potassium bromide to grind the KVR pellet, and I think I demonstrated that on the last lab that we did in that Grignard lab when I was making the KVR pellet, you just don't get your face very close to the work. And so sometimes people want to see what the material is looking like as they're grinding it up, and they have their face very close to the mortar and pestle as they're grinding it, and they're looking at it and observing it as they grind it. Keeping your face a foot and a half, 2 feet away, and being conscientious of not exhaling directly into the mortar and pestle as you're grinding it is all that's really required. But I'll tell you, it's more difficult than that, Keegan, because the CO2 peak is so sensitive that it is sensitive to the amount of CO2 that is in the room itself, because it's an airborne contaminant. And so when I'm teaching IR and I have 12 people in that small IR room and we're all sitting around and I'm demonstrating how to do the IR, every scan we take has a strong CO2 peak because there's 12 people that are just in the room, respiring, breathing in the room. And as people filter out and I get down to those last two or three, what starts to happen is the CO2 peak actually inverts and goes upside down, because when we ran the background scan, there was 12 people in the room. And then as we got into the third or fourth sample, those 12 people in the room had been in there for a long time. So the CO2 increased and got really large. And we started to see large CO2 peaks because the background wasn't able to subtract it out. And then as the last couple of people filter out and I'm down to like the last two, the CO2 in the room goes back to normal levels and they become lower than the background scan. And so when we run those two, what I actually see is the background pulls more CO2 out of the spectrum than the amount of CO2 that's being acquired in the spectrum. And the CO2 peak inverts and goes upside down. And so it's a complicated thing to control. And the best way actually to control it is there's a purge valve on the NMR, on the IR instrument. And what I have is a nitrogen line from the nitrogen tank hooked up to that purge valve. And so if I wanted to take the time, if I were trying to get a really high quality spectrum that I was going to put into a publication, then I would prepare the sample, be careful with the sample, put it into the IR instrument, close the lid, turn on the purge valve and allow nitrogen to run through the IR instrument for 2-3 minutes. That would purge out all the CO2, and then I would run the spectrum and I wouldn't see that CO2 peak. So there are ways to control that, which is interesting. All right, that took me on a far aside, but you get the idea now. Okay, so yes, Zerubin's table is very detailed and great. Let me show you from my perspective how I like to handle it. The top of this that I've got here is sort of like a cartoon. And in fact, this whole thing is a cartoon, but I love it because what it does is it aligns interpretive power and tells you which peaks have the most interpretive power. And as you go down in this cone, we get more specific, but less ability to be able to distinguish between different types of functional groups. And so up here in the red zone, these are things that have the greatest interpretive power. And that correlates to the first box, which is here. And this is the 3,400 to 3,200 range. This is Zeruba's zone one. So we're correlating zone one to this zone here, which gives you the greatest possible interpretive power because it is either there or it's not there. And if it's there, it's very clear what it is. And if it's not there, it's very clear that that functional group does not exist within your molecule. These have to do with the hydroxyl peak, the primary amine, the secondary amine, and then here what we've got is the shaggy beard thing, which is the carboxylic acid. These peaks, the carboxylic acid and the hydroxyl peak, these are strong peaks. When we say strong, we generally mean a peak that goes greater than 50% transmittance. Remember that what we're looking at is the transmitted light that is coming through. And when we say 50% transmittance or maybe 10% transmittance, we're saying only 10% of the original light is making through the sample. And so when we look at these absorbances, oops, I'm moving the whole, there we go. I'm gonna click on the wrong spot. If I go back to Zorubas, it's a little bit easier to see. See, he starts out at 100% transmittance. This means that all of the light comes through and none of that light is being absorbed if a peak or if a line is up at that level. Down here at 0% transmittance, this means none of that wavelength is making it through the sample, making it through the pellet. And so when we see a peak that comes all the way down to 5-10% transmittance, that is an extremely strong absorbance, which is absorbing all the light in that wavelength. So strong, when we say strong, we're generally meaning greater than 50%, somewhere in the 75% to maybe 90% range. That's a strong absorbance. A little bit less than 50%, we would say is a medium absorbance. And somewhere in the 10 to 20%, that's a weak absorbance. So everything that's in zone one, if it happens to be there, is a medium to strong absorbance in zone one, which is why it is unmistakable. It is very hard to miss in zone one. And so we would see a hydroxyl that, like I can use Zorubas because it comes so easily here, that hydroxyl would come down and be somewhere in the 50, 60, even 70% transmittance. It would be a very smooth, deep hydroxyl. The carboxylic acid also tends to be very strong. You can see that he's got it detailed coming down here, 50, 60, 70, as strong as the hydroxyl group. Now, the amines don't come down quite that far. The amines tend to be sort of medium peaks as opposed to strong peaks. So they'll come down maybe 40%, maybe 50%, but they don't come down much farther than that. Still very easily recognizable. So zone one, excellent interpretive power. And I go to zone one. After zone one, the next thing that I look at is Zorubas, I think it's zone four. This is where all of the carbonyls show up. And the carbonyls here in zone four are the next most interpretive because, as I said, this is carbon-hydrogen stretches and very little else that is easy to pick out because every organic compound has carbon and hydrogen in it. And in zone three, the peaks are so weak as to be difficult to distinguish from CO2. And so zone two and three, I don't even look at. I just go straight to zone four. And in zone four, while I like the way that Zoruba has them all denoted out here, they should be taken with a bit of caution in that those can float around. And so what I like is the way that this one is done, where it gives me the, excuse me, let's get the thing working, amides, and it shows me the acids, the ketones, the aldehydes, esters, and hydrides, and then the acid chlorides, and where they all show up at. But then it also reminds me that they can be plus or minus 30 reciprocal centimeters in their orientation based on whether they are strained or conjugated at the oxygen in terms of a carbonyl or conjugated at the carbonyl itself. And that can change where these peaks show up at. And so not to rely on these numbers as being sort of gospel and absolute, but know that they have a 60 reciprocal centimeter range, plus or minus, that they can float to, which makes it a little bit harder to identify, but still extremely useful. So when they say conjugated at the carbonyl, this one here with the double bond on the left of the carbonyl, SP2, SP2, and then SP2 at the carbonyl, those are all conjugated together. And that conjugated, yes, Keegan, this is on chemed.study as well. It's right below Zorubas. I linked it in the exact same place. In fact, I think I can just go back on the Discord and show you that it's under notes and resources. If we go to the top and you scroll down just a little bit, there's the one that I put in there. So it's right below Zorubas where BB had posted Zorubas. And okay, so we've got sure I'm still getting my, yeah, pointer. Okay, so there's the conjugated at the carbonyl. This is where the standard peak would show up. And then if it happens to be an ester, or we have an oxygen that is on the right-hand side, if that thing is strained, or even if the carbonyl is just strained in terms of like a five-member ring or a four-member ring, or the ring is tweaked in some way for some reason, that can increase the number of reciprocal centimeters that we see. Or if there's conjugation on the oxygen side of an ester, that can also change it 30 reciprocal centimeters to the left. So conjugation, electron withdrawing and electron donating groups will also change this slightly. Much harder to actually predict where they're going to go, but just remember that these numbers can float a little bit. So those are the two areas that I go to, and almost exclusively, those two areas are almost the only areas that I go to. And so for me, IR is all about zone one and zone four. And yes, there's a tremendous amount. Let me stop the share for a second. All right. I like to pull these books out and show people these books just for a minute, because I've got two that are really spectacular. This is Spectroscopic Methods in Organic Chemistry. This covers all spectroscopic methods. It covers mass spec, IR, NMR, both proton and carbon. It covers everything. And what it has in here is it has IR tables. And I wanted to see if I could show you some of the IR tables. I think they're at the end of the book. Come on, IR methods. Or not. The tables are extensive. The tables where things show up, maybe it's just better in the other book. The tables where functional groups show up, there are pages and pages. And so it starts here. Of all these different wavelengths for all of these different functional groups, and it just keeps going of functional groups and wavelengths, which is like so detailed in terms of all of these functional groups and wavelengths as to be almost unuseful. You could sit there and go for weeks trying to analyze an IR. This book is even worse, because this book, the number of tables that are in this book are like twice the number of tables that are in the other book. This is Spectral Data for Structure Determination of Organic Compounds, and it goes through all the different types of spectroscopy as well. But like I said, the IR tables in this are extremely extensive. The point of the IR is to figure out whether or not you have a particular type of functional group or whether you don't have that functional group. And mainly that comes down to alcohols, carboxylic acids, amines, which sort of fall in there, and then carbonyls. And everything else you can find in the NMR, and is much easier to find in the NMR. So the IR, you sort of want to get in and get out and not sit there and try to figure out what the molecule is by IR, because you can't. Many of the areas where we look to find compounds or find functional groups within the IR, you can have 15 different functional groups which will show up in the same band. So how do you know which functional group it is just because you're seeing that band? And the answer is you don't, unless you know what the molecule is. But the point of doing the IR is to figure out what the molecule is. So don't belabor it on areas that don't have strong interpretive power. Just go for the ones that do have strong interpretive power. Get in and get out. That's this area here for the hydroxyl type things, and this area here, which is zone four, which is your carbonyls. Now, what else does this chart have? Because it has some other things that are here, which are kind of nice. Triple bonds, carbon-carbon triple bond and carbon-nitrogen triple bond. They show up here where the CO2 sort of shows up, but CO2 oftentimes, I should say CO2 looks, you're not seeing what I'm seeing.
Yeah,
I'm not screen sharing. Yes, I know, I'm learning. Slowly. I'm learning slowly. What just happened there? Stop share. Share screen. Do that and share. All right, now we're better. Okay, so what I was saying was first two zones, zone one, zone four. Those are my major zones. This zone here is Zaruba's zone three. Zone three was the triple bonds. These are carbon-carbon triple bonds, alkynes, and carbon-nitrogen triple bonds, amide groups. And so here, they show up as a fairly sharp but smallish peak. And because they're so small, they sometimes get lost in the background. And most of the molecules that we deal with don't have carbon-nitrogen or carbon-carbon triple bonds, just because we tend not to give you those in spectroscopy problems. So this zone for me has not much value. And then over here in this last sort of zone, this area here is the 3,000 reciprocal centimeters. So to place that zone-wise, 3,000 reciprocal centimeters is right in here. This is the carbon hydrogen stretch area. And what they're saying here is that in this zone, you have unsaturated CH stretch and saturated CH stretch, and where those two sort of show up at. And then over here, they also give you the aldehyde and show you sort of where that aldehyde shows up at and what it looks like. So there's the carbonyl for the aldehyde. And that little tiny peak right there, they're saying is the CH stretch for the aldehyde. Sometimes shows up, sometimes not. Can be helpful, but is difficult. This pattern here and this pattern, these guys can sometimes be helpful. These are the alkene aromatic substitution patterns. They show up, they're saying here 750, 700, 890. So these are in the, I would say 890 to 700 range. 890 to 700 places you, you know, down in this range here. And looking at these guys, this is another very difficult area to try to coordinate. And so unless you know that you have an aromatic molecule and that you're looking for one of these types of substitution patterns, I don't even try to find these. And this book or this graphic doesn't do a good idea or job of showing you what these actually look like in terms of peaks as they show up in that area. So again, I just sort of ignore these guys and I focus all my energy and attention on just these two. So with that in mind, what I like to do is I like to try to go to a website where I can show you some spectrum and talk about what these things look like. Now, there isn't a good tutorial site for IR in the same way that I have NMR and mass spec. What I can do is I can take you to a website that I use a lot. This is the way that I find it, is I search Japan Spectroscopy Database. So the Japan Spectroscopy Database is AIST spectral database for organic compounds. For me, it's just easier to remember that this is a Japanese site, that the AIST name, I always lose track of what the actual name is, but it's the first thing that comes up when you Google Japan Spectroscopy Database. You go to this database and it has a disclaimer. See, the other thing about this is that it is the Spectral Database for Organic Compounds, SDBS, but they also go under the AIST label. And so it gets confusing sometimes. What is the actual name? It's the National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology, which is AIST, which is the organization that makes it, but the database itself is called Spectral Database for Organic Compounds, SDBS. You go ahead and click their disclaimer. And then it takes you into the website itself. Now, this website is pretty incredible. You can search for all sorts of spectra based on compound name, molecular formula. You can do a range of molecular weights, and it will find all of the compounds within the database that fit within that molecular weight range. You can use the CAS registry number, which is how compounds are identified. And if you want to do a subgroup you can use a wildcard in there so that you could pick up all the cast registry numbers that have that vary in one digit or two digits. The SDBS number is the number of the compound in this database, which you wouldn't really know. You can search by the number of carbons, hydrogens, nitrogens that the compound has. You can choose the type of spectrum that you want: mass spec, IR, C13 NMR, proton NMR, ESR, which is electron repulsion spectrum, and Raman, which is like IR, but IR is an absorption, where Raman is a reflection, where they bounce the light off the sample and they look at the light that bounces off the sample. That's what Raman is. It's red almost identically to IR, but gives you slightly different information, which is kind of cool. You can choose the IR peaks, and you can choose multiple IR peaks so that you can search. If you have a spectrum that is an unknown spectrum and you want to figure out what it is, you can list the peaks in the spectrum. It will try to match the spectrum for you. Same thing with the carbon and the proton and the mass spec peaks. So there are tons and tons of ways to search. Let's do a search, and we'll go through and look at, different functional groups in the way that I wanted to go through them. So let's look at some alcohols first. Let's pick 2-propanol. I always forget that I gotta hit the enter. Okay, so here's 2-propanol, and you can see the number of different, it comes up as the first hit, and you can see the different spectrums that they have available in their database. What we wanna look at is we wanna look at the IR spectrum. And there you can see the very classic pattern that is the alcohol pattern. The alcohol pattern has that very broad swoop. Now, I can't use the pointer in this. So maybe what I can do is take it into Notability, where I can use my pointer. And this is 2-propanol. Now, first off, notice the different types of spectroscopy that they have available here. So these are carbons NMR, these are proton NMR, they have it in all different solvents, and they have it in different megahertz. Down below this, if I scroll down, and I forgot that I can go back. If I scroll down, there are different types of IRs too. They have the IR in liquid film. They have the ESR. They don't have it in anything other than the liquid film. So maybe that's what we get. But what we see here is you get the very characteristic hydroxyl group. So this is the zone 1 hydroxyl group that we're looking at. And this is what I mean by a strong peak, is that it's coming down to almost 10% transmittance there. What else is going on in this thing? These guys right here, these are the carbon hydrogen stretches. And then everything else in here, this is all fingerprint. So when I look at this spectrum, what my eye sees is what's recorded in red. And the first thing that I do is I just say this compound has a hydroxyl group. And it's very clear that it has the hydroxyl group. Now there's two different types of hydroxyl groups you should be aware of. This is rather important. The different types of hydroxyl groups are ones that hydrogen bond. So we'll say these are hydrogen bonding. The ones that are hydrogen bonding, these are the ones that give the big swoopy things and then go into the CH stretch. And then this is the OH. Then you have things that, for whatever reason, have sterics on them. And I'll draw some sterics in here that are non-hydrogen bonding. An example of a compound that may be non-hydrogen bonding. And then I'll go try to find one to show you. This hydroxyl group here gets caught up in the sterics of these guys and can't really easily hydrogen bond to other hydroxyl groups. And what happens with that guy is, instead of being broad, it gets very sharp. And so when you have a hydroxyl group or a sharp peak, single sharp peak, which is a strong peak showing up in that same range as a hydroxyl group, and yet it's very sharp rather than broad, it usually denotes a hydrogen that is not hydrogen bonding. And that can be because of solvent. So if we put it in a particular solvent that doesn't allow it to hydrogen bond, for instance, we put it in potassium bromide, where the compound is dispersed and there's nothing for it to hydrogen bond with, that can make it look sharp. Or the molecule is such that the sterics prevent it from hydrogen bonding. That can make it look sharp. And so those are the two things that can make a hydrogen bond look, or an OH group present as being a sharp OH group. All right, let me see if I can find some others that we can look at. This website does not like using the forward and backward buttons on the browser. You have to use their menu items, otherwise you get dumped out of the database. You have to come back in and enter the database again. So let me grab 2-hexanol. Let's see what, yeah, that did not work. Turn the search. My autocorrect is going to mess with me when I try to enter compound names. 2-hexanol. Why is it doing that? Search. I just won't hit the return button and then it won't try to autocorrect it on me. Let's go for IR. Okay, so here they have two different IRs. One that is in a CCl4 solution, that's the one that's being presented, and one which is in the liquid film. There's the one that's in the liquid film. Notice the difference between the two IRs. They look dramatically different. Let me go back to the carbon tetrachloride solution. There's the carbon tetrachloride solution. Notice that in CCl4, that the alcohol is not hydrogen bonding, that it's very sharp as opposed to broad. And you can see the carbon hydrogen stretches very clearly. But when I go to the IR liquid film, the IR liquid film gives me the more classical hydroxyl, because now in the liquid film, what they did is they just took a drop of the 2-hexanol, put it on probably a sodium chloride plate, and the material was hydrogen bonding to itself, which gave the broad swoop to the hydroxyl group. Is that making sense in terms of how I'm describing these two things? And that in carbon tetrachloride, there's no hydrogen. No, that's not forbidden. What are you telling me? I got dumped out of the database somehow. Return to results. I'm just going to dump me out. Yeah, sometimes it times out. I was going to go back and show you, but that's okay. Let's find the carboxylic acid. So eugenoic. Acid. And all of these are esters. Two chlorobutyric acid, that's a carboxylic acid. We can go with that one. And there's an IR for that. There's the IR, and I'll scroll down so you can see the compound shape. So this is a butanoic acid, but it's got a chlorine in it, and this is a specific isomer of that, the R isomer, I believe. Notice that the carboxylic acid here, the hydroxyl group is jagged. And I always like to say sort of why it's jagged. Why does this present as jagged as opposed to the hydroxyl group? It's not. And the answer is because of the type of hydrogen bonding that it does. Okay, so here, now we got it. This zone here is the carboxylic acid. And this one's not as jagged as most of them. And this little part that's right here, these are the CH stretch coming through that. This piece over here, that's the carbonyl of the carboxylic acid. So what we're pointing at is that piece. And then I guess I could do it this way. But that's the carbonyl peak portion of that carboxylic acid. And why does it do this as opposed to the smooth component? And the answer is because carboxylic acids like to dimerize. So if you take a carboxylic acid and you draw one of them upside down, and then you take and draw the carbonyl right side up starting on this side, they like to hydrogen bond in this way. This is a dimer. Whereas most alcohols will hydrogen bond in various manners. And so they can get all different types of hydrogen bonding going in alcohols. And they can have all different types of orientations within alcohols in the way that they hydrogen bond. So over here, we get many bond lengths, which allows for a very smooth sort of transition. Over here, what we get is specific frequencies. And so what we see is we see jaggedness to it, where you see the underlying frequency starting to come through the smoothness because you're getting this dimer formation, which has very unique properties to it. And so the carboxylic acids are almost always jagged as opposed to smooth because of the type of hydrogen bonding that they undergo, forming these dimer formations. And in addition to the jaggedness of this peak, we'll also see the carbonyl showing up over in the 1700 range. And so this one if I wanted to find its specific frequency, I would have to go back here and look at the table, and the table will give me its specific frequency. So I'm looking for something that comes down to about 20% transmittance. That 20% transmittance in the 1700 range is going to be right there at 19% transmittance and 1725. That's the peak that is that carbonyl peak at 1725 for the carboxylic acid. So that's the way that I use the table when I want to find a value in terms of that value. So there's our carboxylic acid. Now, the other thing that we said were amines, that amines can show up in this range as well. So let's see what an amine looks like. Is this, by the way, I can't see your faces because of the screens that I got up. So let me see if I can get, is this helping in terms of being able to actually see what these things look like as opposed to just looking on a table? This is useful. All right, because I like to do things as long as it's useful. And if it's not, then find another way to go. All right. Let me go back to search. Let's search for primary amine, which would be something like hexylamine, maybe. Next, do that. All right. Let's see what comes up. I may need to search on a formula. Cyclohexylamine, that'll work. Let's grab it. Oh, there's hexylamine in there too. Okay, so here's hexylamine. And this is what we're in the carbon tetrachloride solution. Let's go for the liquid film. There it is. Okay. So I was looking at the carbon hydrogen stretches and I was thinking that is not going to be helpful. Can you see? Well, you can't. Let me go to the pointer. I just wish that I had a pointer that I could use all the time. Okay. These guys here are the carbon hydrogen stretch. These guys are the amine. These are the NH. And the fact that there are two of them that there's two peaks here that come down. Those two peaks tell you that this is a primary or I shouldn't say primary amine, it is primary amine. That what we're looking at, amines, when you look at amines, and we have one R group, that's a primary amine. Two R groups, and you're looking at a secondary amine. Three R groups, and you're looking at a tertiary amine, which has no hydrogens on it. And lastly, if you have four R groups, you're looking at a quaternary ammonium. And these have a positive charge on them, which cannot be relieved by acid or base because they're just a function of the nitrogen with four R groups on it. So this is tertiary and this is quaternary. And we usually add the word ammonium ion to it. And so what we see here is with the primary, we typically get the two peaks. With the secondary, we typically only get the one peak. And that corresponds nicely to the two hydrogens and the two peaks that we see, and the one hydrogen and the only one peak that you get for the secondary amine. And so you can see that pattern represented here, the two peaks. But also notice the strength of this, that this is pretty weak. it's not a strong absorbance that shows up on these. And so you need to be careful when you're looking for that, that you're not looking for strong absorbances necessarily. You're looking for fairly weak absorbances as compared to the hydroxyls and the carboxylic acids. And you also need to not confuse it with the carbon hydrogen stretch, which is there for every molecule. So if you're only seeing the carbon hydrogen stretch, then you're not looking at an amine. Amines I find tricky to recognize as compared to other functional groups. They're just a little bit more difficult to try to pick out. Let me see if I can find a primary amine. Turn to search. And a primary amine would be something like, come on, back to search. Sometimes it dumps you back out. I think it has a time limit while you're in the database. And so if you exceed that time limit, it always dumps you back out and you have to acknowledge the database again. So what I want is, let's go for dibutyl. Let's see what happens. Dibutylamine, IR. And we always want to go for the liquid film, not the other solvents. And I think this is the liquid film that's being displayed. And it is. Okay. In this one, this is just really hard to read. It's not clear that this is really an amine just by looking at the spectrum itself. That's going to make it too small. Let's bring it down here. Okay, so the compound has the single proton on it. And what we're seeing here is that that single proton is showing up as that little tiny peak right there. That's your NH. And you see how it's almost lost in the baseline. It could look like it's noise. It doesn't look like it's really helpful. And everything else that is here, this is all the CH stretch. And so trying to see that this is actually an amine, if I were presented with this, I would very easily ignore that and say, this just looks like hydrocarbon to me. And I would call that hydrocarbon because just a little bit of water in your compound, if your compound were contaminated with a small amount of water, it can look like this. So NHs, particularly secondary amines, can be very hard to pick out. The primary easier because they're just a lot. The two peaks are more characteristic. Oops, that's not aromatic. There we go. Okay, so those are our amines. The carbonyl compounds, in showing you carbonyl compounds, there's not a whole lot of point to show you the carbonyls other than just to pick out a couple of carbonyls and to show you how strong they can be and that you're looking for really strong peaks in that regard. It's really the shapes of the alcohols, the carboxylic acids, and the amines that we need to spend the most time on and look at. So if I want to look at, let's pick an aldehyde. Let's pick benzaldehyde. And let's choose the liquid film for benzaldehyde, which I think that is. Okay, so here's benzaldehyde. So what do I see when I look at benzaldehyde? The answer is that the main thing that I'm keying into when I look at benzaldehyde is the aldehyde peak itself. The carbonyl. So if we choose carbonyl here, that's that guy that's showing up there. And that peak is showing up at 1703. How did I find that so fast? I knew I was looking for a 1700, and I look at the one that has the smallest number on it, 4. That means that that's going all the way down to 4% transmittance. This is strong. And that strong absorbance clues me in that this is a carbonyl, not necessarily an aldehyde. Although the wavelength, you know, if we go back to Zaruba's idea here, that Zaruba, let's see what he has for aldehydes. Aldehydes, 1725. So he's giving me an aldehydes at 1725, and we're at 1703. Okay, let me show you mine. Aldehydes, 1725, perfectly agrees with Zaruba's. However, click off here. Okay. 1725 on aldehydes perfectly agrees with Zaruba's. However, this aldehyde is conjugated at the carbonyl. And so conjugated at the carbonyl can move it minus 30. We went from 1725 to 1703. We moved it 22 reciprocal centimeters to the right. We decreased it by 22 reciprocal centimeters because of the conjugation. And that's why it's showing up where it is for benzaldehyde. So how do I know that that's benzaldehyde and not some other type of carbonyl? And the answer is you don't. You don't until you actually figure out what it is. We would need other forms of spectroscopy to be able to help to identify this is an aldehyde. We cannot tell it from the peak wavelength alone. And that's an important message that you should hear. Okay, what else is going on in this? And where is that little aldehyde peak that shows up over here? And the answer is, I have no clue. And this is why I don't even look for it. Let's see where it's supposed to be. We'll go back up to Zaruba's. And Zaruba says that we should see an aldehyde peak in here, in the carbon hydrogen stretch area, 28 and 27. So 28 and 27 should give me the aldehydes. So if that's true, then maybe this is 28 and 27. I'm seeing a 2850, a 2820. Okay, here's what I'm gonna tell you. I don't know. This is why I tend not to rely on that. Now, maybe that's claiming that these two peaks here are 28 and 27. So maybe that's what those two peaks are, but I'm going to put a big old question mark on that because I don't know if I believe that. And many different compounds that are aldehydes are going to have different looks to them in this area. And so this is smack in the center of where carbon hydrogens show up. So I don't like trying to pick out aldehydes out of something that all carbon and hydrogen stretches show up in that region, because that's just too much to ask. And so I don't even try to go there. I just note that it has a carbonyl, and then I move on to the NMR and try to identify what type of carbonyl it is, either in the carbon NMR or the proton NMR. Why would I do that? Because, well, an aldehyde, this is going to show up like around 9, 10 parts per million in the proton spectrum as a single proton that shows up in that range. And the carbonyl here would show up in the 200 range on the, or even the 240, 250 range on the carbon NMR. And so I would be able to identify this as an aldehyde, both in the proton and the carbon NMR, where I would just get carbonyl in the IR, and that's all I would need, is get that carbonyl and get out. So again, it's what the job of the IR actually is that we're trying to do. Okay. Let's do this. Let's show how we start to put these things together. And one way to show how we start to put them together is to go back to the website, go back to ChemEd, Chem12B, additional resources, web spectra, solving problems. Notice that in this database, everything that has a yellow dot next to it has an IR spectrum available for the yellow dot. Let's choose compound 5. Choose the IR spectrum. What type of compound am I looking at? What is the main functional group that clues me in on this compound, on what I should be looking for? What do we see? Casey says OH, alcohol, OH stretch, exactly. That is exactly what we're looking for. So that's the OH one. Okay, there may also, that peak here that is at 1600, that's a little bit low, but the intensity reminds me very much of a carbonyl, in that this compound could also, in addition, have a carbonyl in it, in addition to the alcohol. So watch those carbonyls as they may show up. Let's see what else we've got. Compound 14 has an IR spectrum. That's a challenging IR spectrum. Any ideas what that could be? Primary amine with the two peaks. Yeah, I would go with primary amine looking at the two peaks. Now, it's difficult because there's more than just two peaks. You know, we've got the first one, the second one, and then that third one, which is sort of a carbon hydrogen stretch, which is showing up in the carbon hydrogen stretch. But yeah, I would go primary amine on this one. And so what we can do is we can go back to the problem. We can view the structure. And it is indeed a primary amine. So the quirky carbonyl later on, let me go back to that IR spectrum. That would be pretty quirky if it were presenting that way. It is at 1600 and it's creeping up. It has some carbonyl look to it. In fact, that might even fake you out. It's okay if it does, because you know what we would do? We correlate. Let me see. If this had a carbonyl in it, the carbonyl would show up between, let me go to the carbon NMR. Carbonyls would show up from 1800 on up to 22, 2400. And this has nothing. Excuse me, I said 100. What I meant was 180. On up to 220, 230. And this doesn't have anything in that 180 on up to 220, 230 sort of range. And so this compound does not have a carbonyl in it. And this is what I mean by correlating data. you look at multiple pieces of data to see whether or not they're saying the same things. And if they don't, they all have to agree. If they don't agree, then that means, like, particularly with a carbonyl, where a carbonyl needs to show up downfield of 180, and you're not getting downfield of 180, you don't have a carbonyl based on your carbon NMR, no matter what the IR is telling you. It should be some quirk in the IR, but it's not showing up in the carbon NMR.
So was that strong carbonyl looking signal like something from the nitrogen kind of benzene connection, or?
You know what? I have no idea. That's a great question. And the answer to those questions are that within the compound, there are vibrational frequencies. Remember what IR is telling us. IR is telling us about vibrational frequencies within the molecule that will absorb within certain wavelengths. And those vibrational frequencies can be 2-bond vibrational frequencies. They can be 3-bond vibrational frequencies or more. And that those bonding vibrational frequencies can also be scissoring, stretching, in plane, out of plane. And so a particular molecule can have a stretch that shows up that is in the same range as a carbonyl, but may not be a carbonyl simply because it has a 3 or 4 bond stretch that winds up absorbing energy in the same area as that carbonyl just happens to. However, what will not happen is in the carbon NMR, you will not get something downfield far enough to be a carbonyl if it is not in fact a carbonyl, that the NMR is more accurate and more predictive than the IR, if that makes sense. And so sometimes I may have put a carbonyl as a question mark on this compound, but then as soon as I got to the carbon NMR, I would have crossed off that question mark and said, nope, there's no carbonyl in this. So I rely more on the NMR than I do on the IR. IR is just to get a quick sort of feeling of what the compound might be, in my opinion, in my book. All right, I need to go back to the problems. Let's pick 19 and see what 19's got for us. IR spectrum. What's this compound? What type? JC, good. This is another alcohol, just based on its shape. Let's try 22. What about this one? Some boring hydrocarbon. JC, I love it. That is exactly what this is. This is some boring hydrocarbon. This has no oxygens in the molecule. We can see from the C8H10, but it doesn't have any alcohols. There's no amines. There's no carbonyls. This is what a hydrocarbon looks like. And I don't know if I would go so far to say some boring hydrocarbon, but it is. That's a fairly accurate description. C8H10 means that there's some units of unsaturation. It would be C8H18 if it were saturated. So this has 4 units of unsaturation and is likely an aromatic compound that has 2 methyl groups, if I had to guess. And substitution pattern on the methyl groups we would get in the proton NMR. So if we wanted to figure out what that was, we could go to the proton NMR and we could look at this range here. Those peaks right there are telling me that they are not the inverted quartet. So this is not the A prime, A prime, B, B prime type system. So it's not 1,4. This is showing me a triplet and some other mushy thing. I'm inclined to believe that this is probably a 1,3 substitution. and that there's probably a singlet poking out through something there. So my money would be on the 1-3 rather than the 1-2.
Is that giant signal not a singlet, or?
It's six hydrogens as a singlet, and that giant one is the two methyl groups. Oh, you meant the giant one in here?
Or no, I was looking at the wrong part of it.
That's okay. Yeah, the other one was the two methyl groups. And so if I look at the carbon spectrum, I'm seeing my methyl groups down on the right-hand side upfield at about 20. Those are my carbons. And I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 different types of aromatic. And so those four different types of aromatic, I'm just thinking in my head, if I had 2. Yeah, this is a 1-3 substituted, I'm almost certain. Let's go back and view the structure. There it is. 1-3 dimethylbenzene or metaxylene. Okay, just a couple more. Let's see 24 in the IR. That's another C8H10. This is not the one we just did, right? Now that has me curious. Ah, this is not the one we just did. This is a C8H10, but look at how all of the protons are identical in the aromatic range. In order to get all the protons identical in the aromatic range, that means that I need to have symmetry that makes all the protons identical. So is this a 1-2? We just saw the 1-3, so we know it's not the 1-3. Is this a 1-2 or a 1-4? It is the 1-4. JC, good. You are on it. There it is. That's the paraxylene. Somebody's been practicing. Good job. Let's see 30 and the IR. That's a crappy IR, first of all. This is what happens when you saturate an IR and you put too much compound in the IR. So all the peaks are saturated. And this one, I don't like this IR. I would have a hard time identifying what's going on in this IR because it's that bad. So in this IR, what I'm seeing is that 15, 16, this is like 1690. There's a peak here at 1690, which looks like it could be a carbonyl, but you know, it's not all that intense. The carbon hydrogen stretches are all over the place. And there's no clear carboxylic acid here. There's no clear alcohol here. Basically, this is just a mess. And so I would want to see the proton NMR. The proton NMR is telling me that I have something downfield of 9. That downfield of 9 right there, that doublet at 9.6, that's an aldehyde. So this is an aldehyde, and it does indeed have a carbonyl. It's also aromatic. I can tell the aromaticity from these guys here that are showing up in that 7-8 range. And then it's got some methyl groups which are attached to oxygens as well. So this is an aldehyde, but you couldn't tell that that was an aldehyde from that IR spectrum. That's just unfortunate. Let's go look at the problem answer without trying to do the whole thing. There's the aldehyde and the methoxy group that was in there. And then there's a carbon-carbon double bond as well. So that's just a tough, poorly taken IR, unfortunately. And there wasn't a whole lot to gain out of that IR. Sometimes that happens, but that's why, this is what I'm telling you, is that sometimes going to the proton NMR is way more predictive and can help you sort out what you're seeing in the IR. because you may see things that aren't really there. And when you look at the proton NMR, you go, oh yeah, that's not there, right? Because the carboxylic acid, if there was a carboxylic acid in that IR, then I would have seen a peak for the proton of the carboxylic acid that would have been down around 11 or 12. And I'm not seeing that down around 11 or 12. Plus it would say exchanges on it. And I would know that I would have an exchanging proton down around 11 or 12. That would be a carboxylic acid. And, but that wasn't showing up here in this IR either. Okay. Has this been helpful? So you've seen a bunch of different compounds now. You've seen how to use the IR and how to bring IR into it. And really for me, there's the two main zones. Now, if you want to use Zerubis and you want to follow the four zones and you want to try to dig more into the IR, that's great. I'm not going to ask you that level of depth within the IR. I'm going to use IR mainly for those sorts of alcohols, carboxylic acids, amines, carbonyls. And that's pretty much all I'm going to ask you to try to find in the IR. And then I'm going to ask you to use the rest of the spectroscopy to back that up. So those are my main IR tips. Good. Okay. So at this point at 10:30, I think this is a good time for me to go try to rest my back before office hours start at 11. And then we'll pick it up at 12:40 for lecture. Right? Unless you guys have any questions, if you want me to go over anything more in terms of IR, or you have any big questions you haven't asked yet, this is a good time to get them in. No? All right. I'm going to assume you guys are pretty good. And we've got some more time because we're going to be putting all the trends together. I'm going to go over a little bit more mass spec in lecture for the particular functional groups and what to look for each functional group. And then we'll start doing examples where we put them all together with IR, mass spec, NMR, and we'll use the rubric. And I'll show you how to use the rubric to make sure that you check everything off to make sure that you're getting all the data that you possibly can. So that's where we're going to go from here. All right, let's call it quits. I'm going to stop the share and stop the recording.